Can I add my welcome to you all to what I think is a very important conference? And I was just reflecting this evening that I belong to a debating society in Edinburgh called the Speculative Society. And this was founded in 1764. And among the members of it was Robert Louis Stevenson, Sir Walter Scott. And if you look back to what was being debated in the 1770s and 1780s, guess what? Free will. So, you know, this subject has been of interest to us for centuries, and I've no doubt that in 100 years from now, there'll be people talking about it with a slightly different angle and a new technology, even in advance or way in advance of what we have now. But I still think it will be of very great philosophical and psychological interest. So what I want to do is just give you a few background ideas to this mechanistic metaphor. So what we have to remember is it is a metaphor. And what happens in a lot of modern thinking, particularly modern scientific thinking, is that scientists don't actually realize that they're using a metaphorical thinking, and they think their thinking is a representation of the real thing. But this goes back a lot further, because we're looking at the origins of determinism, and some of this you can see in Greek tragedy. And you all know the example of Oedipus, who was given this prophecy that he would kill his father and marry his mother, and he did everything to avoid it, but it's exactly what he finished up doing. From Oedipus's point of view, it wasn't possible for him to avoid the fate that had been predicted for him. So the Greeks were very, very interested in this, and they're particularly interested also in character flaws, what it was about people that made them do things that they then later regretted. Then if you're looking at this from a theological point of view, particularly around the Reformation, 17th century, you've got this idea of predestination. It's not the same as technically as fate in Greek tragedy, but it's a parallel idea. And you always had this tension between grace and free will, between the efficacy of faith and works. In other words, what you actually did. But faith was more important theologically. And a predestination of whether you were going to heaven or hell. Because at one point, if you had not been baptized, then the theology was that as a child who hadn't been baptized, well, then you're on your way to hell. And of course, this was intellectually unacceptable to a lot of thinking people at the time, but it was a consequence of this omniscience and omnipotence of God. So if you attribute omniscience and omnipotence to God, then God must know what's going to happen. God can make things happen. They're unavoidably going to happen. And then you come up against this another issue that's been debated for centuries and which will continue to be debated for centuries, the theodicy, the issue of theodicy, how you reconcile an omniscient and omnipotent God with the existence of evil. Now, that's not a question I'm going to try and address this evening, but I just pointed out as part of this background that we have in our culture to determinism. In the Middle Ages, one also had this doctrine of providence, and this is Sir Keith Thomas from his famous book, Religion and the Decline of Magic. Providence was a conscientious attempt to impose order on the apparent randomness of human fortunes by proving that in the long run, virtue was rewarded and vice did not go unpunished. And so what they were trying to do was to read what was the significance of the events. And so a providential event that he cites in one of his examples is that there's a usurer, modern term banker, who's getting married. And as he enters the church, a statue of another usurer lands on his head and kills him. And this was thought to be a providential intervention. I don't know whether it was, but it was an example of providence, sort of God punishing somebody for the incredibly appropriate manner of actually having him killed by a statue of the same profession. I don't know how bankers would regard that these days. So this also raised this whole question of miracles and divine intervention. Was it intellectually respectable or even possible for a god to intervene in human affairs? And this reaches quite a pitch in the 18th century, particularly with Hume's essay on miracles, where Hume claims that no miracles are possible by definition. If you want to read a very amusing refutation of Hume's essay on miracles, then one was written by Alfred Russel Wallace, the famous co-discoverer of natural selection with Darwin. And it's a laugh-out-loud demolition of Hume, which is well worth reading. Because in one of the arguments, he says that if a miracle is something you've never seen before, then there would never be sufficient evidence of a flying fish, because everybody knows that fish can't fly. And so if there were a flying fish, it would have been seen already, and therefore there can't have been a flying fish. So, of course, it's a circular argument and doesn't really amount to anything. And then in the wider sense, you've got what Fritjof Capra talks about in his great new book and in other books, The Systems View of Life, is this tension between an approach based on parts and an approach based on wholes. And so the approach he suggests, the approach built on parts is mechanistic, reductionist, atomistic, based on number, identifying with substance, with quantity. And the basic metaphor is that of the building block, or the atom, if you like. The atom was a building block, metaphorically, and in the history of physics. And then the approach based on the whole is holistic, organismic, ecological, looking at pattern rather than number, form rather than substance, quality rather than quantity. And its metaphors are those of order, organization, and relationship. Well, in fact, you can easily see that both of these approaches are required if you're going to have a balanced, integrated view. But as soon as you go over one side or the other, then you've become unbalanced. But what our culture has been scientifically been until recently. Based more on the approach, the parts approach. And before the rise of the mechanistic worldview, there was an organic worldview dating back to Aristotle and espoused by the church. So the church said there are two books that we can learn from. The first is the Book of Revelation, Book of God, and the second is the Book of Nature. And so these were thought to be the two sources of knowledge, and the world was considered to be alive. This changes with the scientific revolution of Galileo and Descartes and the development of mechanics and mathematics and the huge emphasis on mathematics as an ordering principle and the development of tight causal laws and the transition from theism, which is a belief in a personal God, to deism, which is a belief in an intelligence in underlying the processes of nature. And a lot of the 18th century people like Voltaire and then the encyclopedias, they were actually deists. Einstein was a deist. He didn't believe in a personal God. He was not a theist. He was a deist. And this has evolved in modern times to atheism or agnosticism. And so there's a general trend in this direction among scientific thinking. And then the other thing, which is incredibly important, was this distinction made by Galileo, Descartes, and other thinkers between a primary and secondary qualities. A primary quality, so defined, was what you can weigh, measure, see, the visible. It's the tangible. And it's significant that you define the primary in these sensory terms. So the primary is my ability to touch this desk. The secondary is consciousness. It's taste. It's smell. It's quality. And so what you can see is that the tendency would be to arrive at the conclusion that what's on the outside is the basic causal principle explaining what's on the inside. And hence the idea that what is visible can explain what is invisible, and the brain gives rise to the mind. And so the outside causes the inside. Now, I think a lot of what's happening in this interface between science and religion now is going slightly to put that on its head by pointing out that so far as consciousness is concerned, and taking the starting point from consciousness, the inside is primary and the outside is secondary. Now, you might not want to use those primary and secondary labels, but what I'm really pointing out is this: the direction of causality, which is a deterministic direction, is from the outside to the inside. So the physical is the basis of the mental. And this entails the causal closure of the physical world, by which everything can be accounted for in naturalistic, physicalist terms. You don't need any other kind of category. It's all physical. And that's what's called causal closure in philosophy. And it's interesting that physics used to be called, as many of you will know, natural philosophy. And so it's philosophy done within the bounds of an understanding of the physical world. Now we come on to Descartes. And he, as famously as you'll know, established a rigid dichotomy and dualism between mind and matter, and so that matter and bodies are mechanical and mathematically explicable. Certainty is mathematical. So if you get mechanical and a mathematical way of thinking together, then you get the emergence of laws and determinism. And what was very important for Descartes was his idea that animals were machines. And so if an animal appeared to be hurt and distressed, that wasn't really happening. It was just a misperception. And the animal was actually nothing more than a machine. And this seems, I mean, it's completely counterintuitive. But that's the conclusion that he arrived at. And so the bodies are machines. And so our bodies are machines. And this is a metaphor which has run through modern medicine and still does through molecular biology and modern medicine. So the material world and bodies in it are mechanical and to be understood as machines. Now, the next stage of this is Newton with the emergence of the idea of the clockmaker God. And a God who starts the universe off. And God is remote and transcendent and no longer immanent as the world soul. And this is an incredibly important point, because in the medieval period before that, there was an organic understanding of the world being animate, and there being a world soul, there being something inside to correspond to the outside. But if it's just a machine, then the machine can be set in motion, and God becomes completely, the idea of God becomes completely remote. And so that the world becomes a giant cosmic machine, completely causal and deterministic. That's Fritjof Capra's words. And in the 18th century, and I'm just going to come back to this in a moment, there was an absolute fascination with mechanical contrivances. And here's an example of one of these ones. So Jacques de Vaucanson's mechanical duck, which picked up grain, digested and expelled it. And you can see the innards of this duck. And you can even see the sort of entry and exit point. Obviously, there wasn't digestion going on. Voltaire famously said of this duck, he said, "The shitting duck is one of the great glories of France." Voltaire, he was always good for spotting sort of absurdities. But here is your shitting duck, and so you can begin to understand why, if these incredibly sophisticated machines were being made, how it's very easy to slip into this idea that, well, actually, we're the same. So I'll go back, back one again. I'll put the mechanical duck on the back burner. And so what you get from this clockmaker idea is the argument from design, and which is then put forward by Paley in the beginning of the 19th century, where he says if you were to come across a watch or a clock in a field, you would invariably conclude that somebody had made it. And the same applies to the world, and that was his argument. And this was a book which Darwin read when he was a theology student at Christ College, Cambridge, at the end of the 1820s, and before he then was able to embark on his scientific career. And this is Darwin's work is widely thought to have demolished this argument from design. Which in some ways is true, but then you get, and Bernard Carr knows a lot more about this than I do, but you get a reemergence in the 20th century of the anthropic principle as a much more sophisticated argument from design, you know, through the finesse of the constants. So it hasn't really gone away, but the more crude version has. And then in 1747, this man called Lametri in France published a book called L'Homme Machine, which is, nobody reads it these days, but it's I did read parts of it when I was writing my first book 30 years ago. It was probably the first really extensive treatise on examining the implications of this model of the human being as a machine, and in thinking terms, it's sort of forerunner of behaviorism. And then we move on to Laplace, who famously remarks to Napoleon when he's asked about nebular hypothesis, and what about God, asked Napoleon, and he says, I have no need of that hypothesis. Je n'ai pas besoin de cette hypothèse. So that's Laplace, the beginning of the 19th century. So we go back onto the mechanical duck. How does this apply to the mind? Well, there's got a little bit of a history. In the 1870s, T.H. Huxley was writing about the mind and consciousness as like the steam coming out of a kettle. And this was an argument for what's currently called epiphenomenalism. Which is the idea that that consciousness is just a kind of incidental byproduct of the brain with really no causal power. Then in the early 20th century, you get the metaphor of the telephone exchange coming in when the telephones are invented and cables and things. And so you get an update of an analogy which corresponds more closely to the mechanism. And then, of course, the best known one is the brain is a computer with hardware and software. But effectively, no, the brain is a machine. So you've still got this machine metaphor running through it. And then you've got what's happening now, and this is part of Fritjof Capra's argument here, is that we're really moving from the machine metaphor to the idea of networks and systems, a much more distributed understanding of the brain and neural processes, whereby you change the metaphor to a sort of living systems type of metaphor. So basically, summing all this up, the point I've been making is that we have to remember that a mechanistic way of thinking is a metaphor. It's a very powerful metaphor, but it's still nevertheless a metaphor. And it's a lens that we can use to open up certain seams of ideas, but then we need other lenses to arrive at more subtle understandings. Ian McGilchrist would argue that the mechanistic way of thinking is associated with the left hemisphere and with utility and the need to control. And there has been enormous influence of mechanistic ideas in across the sciences, which I won't go into, but obviously particularly on physics and biology, genetics, medicine, and psychology. And I think we're now becoming more self-aware, although I'm still always reminded of what Willis Harmon said. He said that philosophy of science is to scientists what ornithology is to birds. And that it's terribly interesting for ornithologists and philosophers of science, people interested in philosophy of science, but from practicing scientists are rarely terribly interested in the implications of the way they're thinking. They're much more interested in what's going on in terms of immediate results. And I remember Peter in the 80s, 90s, this used to be his very frequent question was, what is the mechanism? You know, and of course, if you ask what is the mechanism, then that's a specific phrasing of a question which can only give you the answer, well, the mechanism is. And so it's obviously asking for the question to be responded to in those terms. And so my conclusion is that organisms aren't mechanisms by definition, and minds, although they might operate in some ways like computers, are not computers, and that although there are limits to anthropomorphism, we also need to watch out for what Rupert Sheldrake calls mechanomorphism, which is a very neat term. And on that note, I will open it up for discussion around the table, or indeed any questions, comments that people might like to make. Thank you.
So, have you resolved any questions that you would like to ask David?
David, when you had your slide of mind metaphors, it struck me that one metaphor which was not there, there are many neurologists nowadays looking at it, is a field metaphor. The idea of consciousness as a field. And there are field theories of consciousness and some very respectable papers that have been published on this, that the reality that which has been known for a long time. Now, back in the early 20th century, several biologists, one called Spaman, and then first began to talk about the notion of a field which controlled the development of an organism. Long before Rupert Sheldrake. And then there were experiments done in Yale by a man called Burr and others who, at the Yale University around the 1940s, on this subject. And today it's actually something which many people are talking about the idea that, about the reality that there is a physical field that surrounds human beings, and the relationship of the field and to the body is a very complex one, and that it is one which needs to be looked at when we are talking about where is the seat of consciousness.
Very much so. Thank you very much, Paul. And you're absolutely right. There's a whole other area of metaphors in which it is very rich. I suppose I was concentrating more on the mechanistic ones. Point well taken. Thank you.
Yes. Hi. David, thanks very much for a very interesting introduction. Now, my question is, free spirits or determined machines? My question to you.
Oh, my question.
My question to you.
Okay. Well, obviously the title is slightly overstates the contrast. And so it was one that we came up with when we were looking at how to dramatize slightly the issues, because clearly there aren't any simple issue, there aren't any simple answers to this, because we are influenced by all sorts of different factors at different levels. But I do believe there is a fundamental freedom about the human being, which I certainly feel. Maybe others people don't, and maybe people looking at me from the outside don't think I'm free anyway. So my inclination is towards the freedom side of the argument. But I think there are degrees of that, many degrees.
Thank you. Eddie Billimoria. I would seriously suggest determined spirit. I don't mean that facetiously.
And do you mean determined in the sense of being determined, or determined in the sense of being strong-willed?
In both senses, but okay. In the sense of a direction in life, but born out of complete freedom and self-determined choice. But just a little...
So self-determined spirit rather than determined spirit.
Yeah. Without splitting hairs.
Okay. Now, I think that's a very important hair to split.
Well, yeah. Fair enough, we'll be splitting them. Yeah. A little request, please don't ascribe the clockwork universe to Newton. It was his followers who looked at it, as Michael has just said, through a mechanistic lens.
Okay.
Because he made it very clear at the outset of Principia that he was only describing force and impulse in the mathematical sense, and not, as he put it, with any relation to real and physical entities and objects. It was a purely mathematical concept.
Okay.
In his alchemy and religion, you certainly find the transcendent and the immanent aspect of divinity, but it's the post-Newtonians who took it through a mechanistic lens. But it's a very apt title, but unfortunate.
Yeah, no, I think that, I mean, you're much greater authority on Newton than me.
Yeah,
no, absolutely, and so, you know, I stand...
But you're absolutely right in...
But I think it's the development of the metaphor that I was really getting at.
But you're absolutely right in putting the word clockwork universe ascribed to Newton, because that's what most people think, yeah.
Right, well, we're all corrected on that one.
Oh.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, who's got the mic? Bernard.
If Ed is going to ask about determined spirits, can I ask about free machines? Because at the moment, you know, one of the really big issues in AI is will machines ever develop consciousness? And this is controversial, and most people within the AI community assume they won't, but that's not at all obvious. And obviously there's a lot of science fiction based upon the question of whether robots will ever become human. And in your historical introduction, I guess you're more focusing on the other question of whether humans are really machines, but the other side of the coin is whether what we call machines will become human. And there is the other side of the coin. Maybe these issues will both be dealt with in this meeting.
Yeah, I think I remember... I was in the Edinburgh Book Festival a few years ago, and I was debating with Kevin Warwick, who wrote a book called The March of Machines. And his view was that eventually machines would take over. And I thought it would be, you know, a real dereliction of our own human responsibility if we allowed machines to, you know, to get to that stage. As to whether machines are conscious or conscious or not, I know this is obviously another specialist area of which there's a lot of debate and controversy. And I think, you know, what is meant by conscious in that sense is pretty impoverished. And I think if you go into the deeper, more emotional aspects of consciousness, then, you know, I don't expect machines ever to be able to replicate that properly.
Well, of course, once they've developed these human characteristics, they would no longer be machines. So it's partly a matter of terminology. But I don't see any reason in principle why eventually something originally built by humans shouldn't develop consciousness and indeed develop spirituality. Maybe...
Well, that'll be a very interesting conference for sort of 2075 or something. Yeah.
Okay. Who's got the mic? Yes, over there. Oh, you have it there. Okay.
And maybe there'll be a speaker, which is a machine.
Yes. I think probably we'll have to stop after two questions. Marilyn, I know you want to ask one, and I know you want to ask one, and you've got the mic, so let's have those three people.
Okay, I'll be quick. John Capp, I see my body as my hardware, my mind as my software, which is basically, and myself, a higher self, as a soul or consciousness, as controlling it, just as I control my computer. Do you agree?
Well, fair analogy in many ways. I suppose what the argument would be is to what extent you're separating these functions, and to what extent you can actually use the word control in this, because we're sort of obviously in our current form, we're psychosomatic entities, and we get feedback going both ways. But yes, I believe in some more fundamental level of self. But I think ultimately we are one self, and we're refracted through these different lenses. And that's so in fact Peter's conclusion that there's no separation, there's only one consciousness, is I think one of the ultimate insights.
Okay, Martin.
You almost answered what I was going to say. Free spirits or determined machines isn't a complete sentence. The first part of that sentence is that's not written is the key, isn't it? What are free spirits or determined machines? Who's talking? It's the subject-object consciousness that you were talking about and that Rupert Spira talks about. While we try and have a separate subject, it doesn't make any sense. Once the subject goes and it becomes universal consciousness, then one doesn't need individual freedom.
And yet you're freer than you probably ever could be.
Exactly.
Without being in that, if you weren't in that state of consciousness. So it transcends the category.
Okay.
I would suggest that machines are already dehumanizing society very considerably. So, for example, I was privileged to have a semi-stroke some years ago, and it was discovered that I had a hole in my heart. I went to a hospital, and they did a fantastic job in putting a thing through the ventricle, you know, up there and clipping it up. I was cycling again within 2 weeks. 3 months later, I went to see I wrote a wonderful letter to the consultant, the hospital, and just thanked them for the amazing job they'd done and how well organized it was. I saw the consultant 3 months later. He said, "Thank you so much for that letter. Do you know, the managements hate us. Because what you've got now in management is people in front of machines looking at graphs, looking at statistics, and they are completely separate from what it is to be a human being. And that is happening globally now with banks and everything else. And I would suggest that machines are already a major destructive force to humanity."
Thank you.
Marilyn.
Yeah, once again, I'd say it's not either or. It's both. And reductionist scientists, I mean, the reductionist method is to have one variable and try to keep everything else constant. And I was just sharing at the table, if you wanted to know how a car worked, you'd take off a wheel and it wouldn't roll. Okay, the wheel's needed for rolling. You take off the steering wheel, you couldn't steer it. Okay, the steering wheel's needed for steering. But you know that all the bits of the car are all connected and working in harmony to make the car work. So you know about the interconnectedness and everything being important, and you analyze it by looking at one thing at a time. So it's not like reductionist science doesn't understand interconnectedness. And when you get about, you know, when you come to life, it's far more complicated because life has so many fail-safe and backup mechanisms for dealing with something you knock out. But in fact, interconnectedness in science is very common now because you can look at a whole genome and you'd look at every 20,000 genes, and you can work out the exact level of expression of each one of them associated with various conditions and lifestyle diseases and so on. So you can look at everything, and it's too complicated. If you just take the metabolome, you've got 3,000 interconnected biochemical reactions. They're all connected to each other, and they shift. The whole thing shifts. The products and substrates and gene activity shifts according to whether you're starving or you're drinking alcohol or you're stressed, and everything shifts, and it can shift around and shift back. And that's too, it's, you can't study that by mass spectrometry. You can't look at 3,000 things all at once, but you can, but then you find out that there are sort of key players, you know, like government whips. There are about 10 key players amongst 3,000 biochemical reactions, and if you look where those key players are, the levels of expression, you can say this is a starvation metabolome, this is a stress metabolome, this is a drugged metabolome, this is a well-being metabolome, and you can, so that interconnectedness and reductionist approaches to life can happen, you know, at the same time. I mean, science is not all reductionist. It's just one approach, and you know, it's not like either or. And in terms of free spirits or determined machines, the free spirit can shift things around. And then they can shift, you could shift your metabolome from a well-being metabolome to a stress metabolome. So your free spirit, you could put it there, but you're determined now because that's over there. And it's going to take some time and some effort and some change in your lifestyle to bring it back again. So it's not either or, okay? That's all I want to say.
No, quite right. And I think there's a much greater appreciation of complexity now than there was even 15 years ago.
There's always been an appreciation of complexity, but there haven't been the tools
to
look at everything all at once. Now we have the human genome, we have the human methylome, we have the metabolome, we have a microbiome. We can look at everything at once now. But that you can identify how things are shifting around in terms of interconnectedness, and it's the interconnectedness, it's what's between things, is much more important than the things themselves. It's what it's how they're talking to each other that's more important in determining what's going on. So it's always been, interconnectedness has always been known, but there haven't been those sort of high throughput tools to look at it. So, but there
which
are none.
Which we now have, which
we
is
now
great.
Have, yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, well, we'll have to end there, I'm afraid, because we must now move on to the last part in the evening. Just before we all thank David, I must say that the view which I take on this is very much the view of Nietzsche, and that is the idea of the last man alive. And in his philosophy, the last man alive was in fact due to the mechanical nature of man. And although he talked about Superman, it wasn't Superman in terms of Hollywood, it was Superman in terms of the evolution of consciousness, and that I like very much indeed. His argument is that man is multidimensional, and this is probably where one is going in some of these new transcendent states, into a multidimensional realm. At any rate, this is what this conference is about. So let's all thank David very much indeed for starting us. Thank you.